Welcome to Terragrams. I am Craig Verzone and I'll be your host for the 28th Dispatch of Terragrams. Terragrams has reached a critical impasse in its evolution and is in aid of assistance. To continue, Terragrams must rely on contributions from listeners like you. Your support will assure that you, your colleagues, studio, faculty body, students, and classmates can continue to benefit from our growing and open archive as well as our forthcoming conversations. All donations count. Please help. Visit our website at terragrams.com for more information. Today in Dispatch 28, we are joined by the Swiss-German landscape architect Stefan Rotzler. Rotzler studied history of art at the Zurich University before becoming a gardener. Following this hands-on experience, Rotzler opted to study landscape architecture at the ITR Technical School in Rapperswil, Switzerland, where he graduated in one of the first classes of the newly created professional program. After graduation, he worked for the town planning office of Zurich for a few years and then opened his own office. In 1989, he began his collaboration with Matthias Krebs, who together have made projects for gardens, public spaces, sports facilities, and infrastructure, primarily in Europe. In 2007, the Swiss publishing firm Nigli released the first monograph of the Rotzler-Krebs collaboration. Rotzler has taught in the landscape program at Rapperswil and has participated widely in international competitions, juries, and workshops. Terragrams is very happy to welcome Stefan Rotzler.
The garden was on a flat land on the east side of Lake of Zurich, on a flat ground composed by the gravel of Gotthard Tunnel in the 1870s. They didn't know where to go with all this gravel, and well, they did the lake borders of several lakes in Switzerland, and that's where this exhibition took place. And Kramer was invited by two young chaps, Neukomm and Baumann, to do a little creation. They gave him this name, Garden of des Poeten, and he took some earth, created several pyramids, a mound of earth, a flat water basin, and some concrete slabs, no trees, no bushes, just one pot with a red geranium. Is it ironical or is it more the yin-yang thing relating to the many, many flowers of the 59 garden show? We don't know.
So it wasn't very characteristic of his work?
No. There obviously was a break in what he had done before. His earlier garden work is very much into flowers, and Kramer had come to a point before 55 where he found out, I don't get any longer with these plants. I could repeat and repeat, but there's no more challenge. So
he was very good with the plants, no?
He was excellent with plants, and for him it was a pleasure to do the execution of gardens in front of the owners. That's known. He took one blue flower, put it there, and then, in a way of a theater play, brought a tree and then brought a stone. So he was a kind of a regisseur of the creation of these gardens. So that was showtime, and Garden des Poeten is it's showtime on another level.
It was controversial before. There was discussion before the expo to not build this piece. What gave it the impetus to actually get constructed?
Well, that's where the story of my family comes into Kramer's life and probably my relation to modern landscape architecture is based. My father was the art director of the garden exhibition, and when the gardeners decided, no way, we will not construct this abstract garden with no plants, it'll be a shame, a national shame. Then my father, as the art director, said, well, we consider it a piece of art and we do it. And that was before 68. He was the authority in arts, and they did it. And that's how this strange relation, or this specific relation of garden work and art piece started and had the chance to be built and then to be discussed and then to be demolished.
And was there a lot of controversy during the expo or after the expo about this exotic corner in the festival?
Well, we found out that there was quite some controversy in the newspapers. Some people liked it and thought that's the beginning of something new. It's a new way of doing gardens because it's unfenced, it's open, it's you enter it, and by entering the garden it gets physical, and your physicality and the garden's physicality amalgamate. So that was discussed at the time. So that's very much land art thinking. And of course there were the journalists and the public who didn't care about what is there, thought it's a mistake, it's too abstract. So there was a lot of discussion. Mm-hmm. Caused red heads, and by doing this exhibition 50 years later, I hope, or we hope, that again there is some red heads and people discuss violently about landscape architecture and how abstract it can be and how radical it can be.
Does the project still seem controversial today?
Yeah, people coming in here in the architectural forum, of course, come to see the exhibition. There's not much of controversy, really. I hope there will be more, but that's my hope that didn't fulfill.
Did this work in Kramer's career signify a change in the way he developed his and designed his gardens?
Yeah, I think it did. His work developed along exhibition gardens. He did every 10 or 20 years there was a garden exhibition, and he was present at these gardens. Some of them, no, all of them are extreme in a way. They are extremely ugly or extremely stupid or extremely, extremely earthy. And the second last project he did in Hamburg in 63, it was only concrete. So that was also caused quite a lot of trouble. And then the last exhibition project he did was IBA in Berlin in the, was it in the 70s? So he somehow developed along these exhibition projects. It's like a musician. He rehearses and then he has concerts and develops along the concert, maybe.
Did his tactics infiltrate into his private gardens or his parks?
Yeah, it did. It surely did. The Garden des Poeten, I think, is the beginning of something new in his life. And there is private gardens in the same manner. Of course, private people want to have their sitting ground and their bench and the swimming pool, but these elements are present. And the spirit, the radicality of the spirit is visible and feasible also, yeah.
So at the end of Kramer's career, in his retirement, he turned over a number of gardens to you, a young practitioner, just coming out of the school of Rapperswil, and you were to inherit this extreme tradition or spirit. How did you handle that as a green, a young, a new professional?
I didn't realize what happened at the time.
A fortune or fate.
Huh? Yeah. I got these two letters by architects telling me I'm the one to continue with this project. And I was just at the very beginning of my professional career and thought, okay, why not? It's jobs. I do it. He had begun two gardens. He had begun the conception of the parks, of the gardens, but there wasn't much. So I started completely new, and I made every mistake you can make as a young professional in these two gardens. Every mistake. Instead of using a normal stone, I used a red stone. Instead of giving a close look to the topography, I changed topography in a strange way, and so forth. And the plantation was completely wrong. Everything was wrong. Well, it's not bad doing your first gardens for an enemy. And so I punished these owners, and well, punished, not in a literal sense. And 3 or 4 years later, the garden was changed or was redone by another colleague. So there wasn't much damage, but a lot to learn. I mean, learning is by making mistakes, I think. If you're not making mistakes, you don't learn. The problem is, who pays for your mistakes? Do you pay yourself, or does your boss pay, or who pays for these mistakes? So I didn't realize at that time what it meant to be the, well, to have this inheritance of two gardens. But there's still some of the tools he had in his office, the optical instruments to level the grounds.
The surveying equipment
is still used in our office. It's from the dates from the 30s, but it's still in functions, and some other optical instruments are still used in our office. So that's nice, having this memory. And then, of course, it was more the images and the words this old man gave to me. For example, the image of a rather big and voluminous man sitting at the table doing his sketches and pushing sketches away from him. So it was very physical, the way he did sketches, and his office was full of sketches. I mean, it's not very serious. Sketches are always something to throw away, and that probably gave me, well, an intention or an idea of, yeah, inventing, destroying, throwing away. So that's what it's all about. Designing is about deciding, and deciding means saying yes or saying no.
Do you still carry the weight of his past? And the weight of this transition from the end of his career to the beginning of yours? Are you regularly reminded of Kramer, the professional?
No. I mean, by doing this exhibition 50 years later, of course, I had to re-go through all these memories, and it's maybe like a psychoanalyst. I mean, you go through a story again, and then you work on it, and you can get rid of it. So maybe I get rid of it. Not too much, hopefully, because, it's very accurate, the thoughts he had.
In 1978, you graduated from the technical school in Chapuzvin. And I believe, if my memory serves, you were one of the first graduating classes in the program of landscape architecture. Who founded the program? Who were your classmates? And what's going on with the first band of landscape architects now?
The school was founded in the 70s by the profession of the landscape architects, and the first professor in design was Burnow. He had come from Berlin. Well, he wasn't really a big help to us, to the young students who wanted to reinvent the world. This old chap in the, well, in his 50s manner of designing. I remember we had a very small class. We were six guys only in our class. Three of them are gardeners. One of them has disappeared into another profession, and so there's two left who are in the field.
Do you keep in touch?
Yeah, we meet irregularly. I mean, the world is not that big in Switzerland, so you have no chance. You meet each other again.
Who are they?
Zuber is in Bern. He's in the Bern administration, and well, that's the one I meet. The others do something else, or one of them has his own firm as a gardener. Yeah.
Before Rapperswil, I'm going to go backwards. You studied history of art at the Zurich University. Then you went on to be a gardener. Do you look back and see these 3 years of time as influential or formative?
Yeah, sure. I mean, my family is on an art historian base, so this meant looking. It meant visual arts. I mean, art is about taking your time, looking at something, looking at it very closely, and that's what I probably learned in these years, and what I learned from my father, giving it a very close look without saying, no, I like it or I dislike it, just looking and taking this time to see what is there. I somehow got sick of studying history of arts. To me, it was much too unphysical, and that was the hippie shake time. You had longer hairs and flower power on your bicycle, and during these years there was a change. I decided to become first gardener and then study the landscape architecture. So it's both on the visual background and on the on the physical background of a young man who grows up and thinks, well, it's not all about intellect, it's about physicality. Life is about physics. And that's, here I see a little relation. You didn't ask me, but it's a nice nice moment to bring it up. I think there's a good relation between pop music and landscape architecture. As pop music, well, Madonna thinks I'm a physical girl. Is she singing it, or who does? Well, never mind. She sings about physicality, and it's loud and it's wild and sometimes it's rough. And that's three or four points you can bring up talking about pop music that also make part of the profession of landscape architecture. It's about mud, it's about dirt. That's where it all begins. Mm-hmm.
But if we look at some of your gardens, some of your parks, your landscapes, although there's a wildness, a roughness, a loudness to them, there's also a minimalism and a control, almost a precise measurement to them. How do you balance the two aspects of your work?
Well, I think minimalism is a point to to start with. Minimalism is was related to conceptual art, and conceptual art means it's very reduced to three or four statements. It's not all, it's not, well, it's reduced, and reducing contents and reducing ideas, I think that's what it's all about. And reducing means it allows you to create a picture, and creating a picture allows you to photograph it. So there's a strong relation between creating these strong images and having strong pictures from what you did. There comes in the world of medias, of publications. I sometimes ask myself how much media generate your design. Am I creating pictures for media? Am I creating something that looks nice in a book? Or what exactly is the point about it? But I don't think you can separate between what you design and how it's published. So that's a very, very strong relation. Minimal projects or minimal thoughts can be reduced to one or two or three sentences. I used to tell students, it's a good garden or a good conception if you can explain it to your grandmother on the telephone. So that brings in all the this media aspect. Mm-hmm. Say it loud, say it in a short way, and tell someone who has whose capability of hearing is not that strong.
But aren't you overlooking the sensuality of place and the experience of place if it gets boiled down to media and publication? Even through video, there's a certain detachment of place.
Well, that's right. I mean, it's also a certain irony between, about what I said. There's a debate between the Dutch way of creating, of designing a landscape by just doing sometimes stupid, simple things. Best Art, for example, to me is a media or a PR agency and not the landscape architects. And, fortunately, in our country, in Switzerland, we have a different culture of designing. We have a different landscape, and the product is very different. So I think there's a separation between the Dutch way of over designing and doing these two things you can explain to your grandmother very quickly, and to the complexity of our culture in design, and it's different. So you got the point of irony I had in my previous little statement.
What do you think drives the intense desire towards creating minimal landscapes here in Switzerland? If you agree with that as a generalizing statement.
Well, it's a long history of graphic arts that were famous in the 30s, in the 40s. It's a tradition in architecture that still is more or less accurate. The roots to it certainly are in other professions or in other arts.
How does the work and the influence of Dieter Kienast relate to the notion of minimalism and the force that it has in the profession today?
Well, it sure does. We talked about heritage. Kramer for sure is a grandfather. He's not the father. He's a grandfather to us. He was a grandfather to Kinas as well. I think that's the root of this kind of thinking is Kramer, and Kienast was a very clever and very accurate designer, and he invented the profession in our country. That's for sure. He came as a professor to Rapperswil, and then also had several changes in his life. He started with, if I'm correct, with his doctorate was about reeds in Kassel, in German towns, and
about what?
Weeds and weeds. Moss and mm-hmm. all the weird plants that exist in towns mm-hmm. where people walk and spit and piss. Mm-hmm. So that's where he started. So a very urban way of looking at nature, or at urban nature. That's his beginning, and he brought in this urban aspect into our country. And our generation, my generation, is very aware that we are living and working in an urban area. Mm. And that's definitely the idea and the result of what Kinasht told us, told the profession, about what he told the architects. So there's the urban aspect coming in. That's different from Kramer we talked about earlier.
Because Kramer really
did gardens
in a residential
manner, and well, there's some urban projects, but it's not the main point. Isn't urbanism.
Today it seems obvious that landscape architects practice in the city.
Yeah.
So there's a real transition that's occurred over the past three generations.
And that's, to add something, isn't it interesting that the profession develops and spreads out? The more urban this country gets, the more there is a necessity for landscape architecture. That's interesting. And, well, in a way it's clear, as space disappears or gets narrower, the estimation of space is higher, and it's more important to, how shall I put it?
Well, in fact, much of our work is no longer in the residential, and it is more so in the urban today.
In the urban. It's always only about the urban. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's metropolitan, not the way it's received by people, or but the reality is really urban in this country. I mean, it's a metropolitan area, and the parks in metropolitan area are the constant aspect, the eternal aspect, and the built disappears and buildings are crumble and are destroyed, but the open spaces remain. So that's what I meant.
In Switzerland, we're fortunate to have an incredible landscape. We have a highly diverse agricultural territory. We have sublime mountain ranges. We have archetypal villages. However, in formulating a contemporary practice of landscape architecture within this framework, has it been difficult for you to fight or combat this traditional, what could be a disposition towards traditionalism and conservatism and conventionalism regarding perceptions in the landscape?
I don't think it has been difficult, as there's an economic point to it. Projects, buildings, and investments are sold with the aspect of landscape architecture. This means if they, well, and are named after landscape. For example, Glattpark near Zurich, that's a park. And the whole area is sold with the idea of a lake and a park. So this profession is very close to the economy. Mm. And if the landscape is good, the project can be sold. It's different from other projects. Well, that's a strong value in the economy.
Do you have trouble selling your modernism or your what could be a more radical idea, or is it easier to do today than it was in 1959 when Kramer or your father had to sell the idea to the rest of the Expo administration?
I think it's easier. Well, there's a field we're all working in, and well, a field or a machine, if you want, and this machine works through competitions and works through, well, workshops and test planning, and there always has to be someone winning. And if there's a winner, there's people to lose. And if there's a winner, there's someone to judge you. So this competition aspect is rather important today. And you have to be able to compete in this struggle. This is a pleasure for me or for us as an office to be part of this competition struggle. But you're right. I mean, there's always the mainstream aspect and the aspect of the outstanding projects. And probably, the longer you work, the more people want you for what you do, or they know that taking you, they can expect something, or they want you because they know that there isn't a traditional work coming out of your office.
Do you think it then makes it harder for young design offices to break into the field?
I don't think so. Well, there's not that many professionals in the country. Well, we all have we all have a good relation, and if he does a good project, this helps me, and if we do a good project, it helps someone else, and that's great for younger people to come in. Of course, there's always the aspect of who knows whom, and what kind of relations do you have to the people with the money. Of course, that's in times of harder economics, it can be harder for young guys to come into this professional fields. But many of the young guys win competitions, and that's how they get their jobs.
You were listening to Terragrams, and our guest is the Swiss landscape architect Stefan Rotzler.
You've been running your office, now a joint collaboration with Matthias Krebs, for 28 years. Still a young practice, in a way. What kind of advice do you give to the younger practitioners who are trying to launch their studios?
I tried to give this advice when teaching at ETH, and one of them is being simple, being recognizable. One of them is being able to communicate what you do. That, I think, is the most important and the most difficult thing. When in our office, for a certain time, we forced to people to explain projects in 3 minutes or in 5 minutes to the others. And that is extremely difficult. if you're so close to a project and so familiar with everything, every aspect in the project, and then have to explain it in 3 minutes, well, that's hard work to be done. Communicate or write down what you do, if you can write it down, and if you can express it in words orally, then your thoughts and the projects really cling together, and there's nothing unsaid in the project.
Would you attribute your success in competitions towards the strategy?
Yeah, maybe that's one of the points in success. And the other point is, I like young professionals to be in juries, and I always enhance investors to take young people into juries, because then you realize, or they realize, how decisions are taken.
Mm-hmm.
And generally in competitions, I think professionals, our profession works too much. They go too much into detail, and going into details forces you to make mistakes.
Mm-hmm.
And mistakes evoke questions,
mm-hmm.
and questions in the face of competition are dangerous.
So would you say the more you do competitions, the less time you spend on them?
Well, that's an ideal. That would be an ideal thing. But generally, you're right. The best competitions, some of the best competitions, are very quickly drawn, and then are strong or dirty or pop songs in a good manner, and then you're in a competition and it never ends. You don't find a way out, and you do some research about this, and you change again. So this is this happens, and you never know. In advance, you never know.
Mm.
I wish you would. I'm in a competition now. Endless. It's endless. We find it, we throw away, and I could give this advice. We just found out, don't work too much on things I could give to myself.
Mm. What are you working on? What's the competition?
It's a big competition for a new urban development near Bern. It's called Wankdorf, where the national football grounds are, near Bern. A very difficult one.
What are the difficulties that are posing you today on the project?
Well, finding out the two or three points the project is about. It's about something entire, something integral, and it's about parts, and it's about how these parts and the whole work together, how separate can the parts be, and how are they related, or how are they, what is it that brings these parts together? So it's about the whole and not the detail, the whole and the parts.
How will you know when you have the whole and the parts all together?
Yeah, this afternoon we'll finish the competition, and I think we have it now.
Uh-huh.
So it's
it's getting printed tomorrow.
Yeah, not tomorrow, but next week it'll be printed. No, when you have these showering in the morning, or getting up early in the morning. Oh, I have to tell you that I'm living near Zurich Airport, and every morning, 6:02, we have these damn airplanes flying in from the south, right over my roof, and that made me change my life, or change the rhythm of my life. I'm awake when these planes come, and then I have the best minutes or the best hour of the day with my coffee and the shower. And in these moments, I know it's okay, or I realize we are still struggling with Wankdorf, but it doesn't bother me anymore. So probably within the end of finalizing and printing.
Many of the competitions are heavily scripted and strictly regulated. Do you make it a practice of following the rules to a T, or can you break out of that and introduce what can be a new idea and actually an improvement to the codes that have been set down by the planners before the competition has been organized?
Well, in many cases, we realize that be it ourselves or others, the guys that do not respect the regulations, they win. Because they find a point. Well, I can put it another way. A program or a competition is written down because there's a conflict. And the way people see these conflicts and describe these conflicts, that makes the program. And going back to the main issues, to the main questions, maybe makes clear that the question is wrong. That's what Günter Vogt in the exhibition we are sitting in says. Well, it's all about asking the right questions. And if these questions in a competition program are wrong, then obviously the answers are wrong. So I don't take program serious. I mean, you have to fulfill what you're asked to give in, but don't cling too close to what is written down.
You need to say, stay slightly suspicious.
Slightly suspicious, yeah. Subversious, exactly. And radical, too. Well, radical is an interesting word. I mean, I don't want to go too much into semantics, but radical means, the word goes back to the Latin and means roots. So being radical is going to the roots. Mm-hmm. And that's not a bad point.
Like a beet or a radish.
Radish is the same word. Radish is the little red thing. It's in the earth, and it's sharp. Mm-hmm. Being sharp, radical, and red.
Who is Matthias Krebs, and how did you meet, and what are your roles in your studio, Ratzler Krebs' partner?
Matthias Krebs is a little younger than me. We met at the school. I was his diploma expert, and I was extremely touched by the way he finalized his diploma. It was very light and very intelligent. And it was on a strange brown piece of paper, so that touched me. The brown paper and the way he took things serious and at the same time was a little laughing about himself and maybe about me. And he wore nice shoes. So that's the other point, the nice shoes and the good project brought us together. He was in my office and then became a partner. And
how did you know it was time to create the partnership?
Well, that's one of these moments physically, you have to do it. I had several partnerships. Two of them broke up because there was useless discussions about anything. And with Matthias, we have hard discussions. That's normal. But we never had discussions about these stupid questions, who cleans the office and all this rubbish questions. We're three partners now, so the two of us are more design or creative directors, and we have an organizational director in the office who is more in charge of the contracts, the money, the organization, the risk management, and that's really nice.
The third having pillar.
This, the third pillar, as you call it, that is great. Mm-hmm. It definitely wasn't my thing in the beginning, this third pillar, but it's great to have it, absolutely great, as it creates freedom and new possibilities.
It takes a certain scale of operation to have a third pillar. How big are you now?
We're about 20 people sitting in Winterthur.
Just since 10 years? This is a growth.
Well, it's been growing slowly, and getting bigger never has been an issue. I mean, it happened. You have projects, and you have another project, and it's big, and it's there's a new thing, and you win a competition, and that's how slowly we had to spread out. And it's great. Being 20 people is great. I mean, it's not a factory. It's almost a brand. Maybe not, or maybe not yet, but it's nice. You can work on bigger projects, and, well, you can do it quick. That mm-hmm. is great.
Mm-hmm. What do your colleagues bring to the work?
What do my colleagues bring to the work? Mm-hmm. The partners or the...
Everyone else.
Everyone. Well, it's all about chemistry. I mean, everything that happens or is said is part of the design finding process. So there is a very flat hierarchy, and well, I can say it. I don't know what people in my office would say about it.
They'll tell you soon.
They'll tell me and say, you're a liar. You're blind, chap. No, whatever is said is taken serious, and every proposal is... at first glance is a good proposal, because you have to give it a very close look, and you have to find out about the potential, and and to us, maybe that's something specific for our office. Design goes through every phase. I mean, we're not a Dutch office doing the wonderful sketch and visualization, and that's it. But, well, we think conception goes through every phase. Building is creating the execution of a garden means design goes on, and bringing in design in every phase, that's... what makes the good projects. So I wouldn't want to have an office just designing and then, whoops, we don't care who does it, what happens with it.
Do you really think West 8 runs their work like this? You're being very critical on the Dutch.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you have to differentiate or have to see or recognize your own point, and maybe in my... the way I express what I think is important, I have to find a point. It's like Pythagoras saying, give me this one strong point in the world and I can lift the whole world up. So don't take it too serious.
Okay.
I mean, it's different ways of looking at the same questions, and the cultures are, of course, different.
How do you recognize in your office when a good idea is born? And then, a parallel question, do you feel like you have a responsibility or a burden to invent? To be inventive?
To invent. Well, invented, that's hard questions you give me. Well, knowing the first one, finding out when something is at the climax. Well, I think this is physical. I don't know. How do I realize it, or how do we realize it? I have to think about it. But definitely there is a point about it, because there is offices that never stop changing, remodeling. That's not the way we work. There's points when we say that's it and we don't touch it anymore. I think it's when you feel that a certain energy flow goes through a project. It's not this and that, and it's not additional, and all the parts communicate, the part of the project communicate, and it's emotional, then probably the moment has come when we say, buff, stop it, that's it. We do it, and it's okay, it's being built. And then you always realize when things are built that things can be wrong. So it's about not being anxious, to see your projects in reality. Why not making mistakes or taking risks? It's not the lust to make mistakes, but maybe the lust to take a risk.
Do you think that accepting mistakes is partly about growing up? And what does it take to grow up? And do you feel like you have?
I feel I have grown up. Yeah, that's another one. Maybe the opposite happens. Being grown up too much means you're blind to what is emotional, and you're blind to what the child could do, or you're blind to the real basic things. So I hope I'm not too grown up, but still I'm a child that has its lust to dig in the earth and to play with things.
Your work is fun, in a way. Why do you care to make making landscape, or to make landscape fun? And what do you think makes it that way?
Well, taking an example to give myself time to think about your question, we did a, it's not directly the answer, but it goes a little bit around. We just finished a big job for a very, very, very dense urban construction. It's extremely dense. And well, there was the question, how can people live here feeling they're living in a ghetto? And we used to create these gardens. Now that's the first season. We took, not only, but we took 70,000 red tulips and created this field of tulips. And I don't know, but people feel very easy there. And they think, that's our surroundings. Oh, that's our tulips. So that gives kind of a freshness, or a kind of fun, and kind of a, well, identity, and kind of a meaning of the place. And that is fun. If you take Sigmund Freud, he says a joke is when things come together that physically don't belong together. And that, well, evokes energy. And energy is good and makes you laugh, and energy is fun. So that would be probably the answer. Mm-hmm. It's the lust to bring things together that not really belong together. I mean, you can go back in history of art and talk about surrealism, the encounter of a sewing machine, and what was it? I forgot. Who was it? Mallarmé brought two unbelievable things together, a parapluie and an umbrella and a sewing machine, exactly. That by that he defined surrealism. So there's quite something behind it, and Freud as well. What makes you laugh? It's the strangeness of a situation or the strangeness of things coming together. These urban blocks, extremely dense and some of them grey, people living in a dense community and then having an incredible amount of red tulips. That gives energy.
Have they bloomed yet?
Yeah.
So this is the first season?
The first season. I can show you, not in Terragram, but I can show you photographs of the... And then red... We didn't start the office by saying, well, we like red, we do red jobs. I mean, it's not about... It's not a PR gag, public relation gag. But somehow we always come back to this aspect of red. Why? I don't know. I'm wearing a red pullover today. Why is it?
Is it about color and the juxtaposition of strange things coming together?
Maybe. Well, color is one aspect or one possibility of bringing strange things together.
When do you know when to introduce color? You use it quite often in your work, and it becomes a real framing tool.
We didn't know until Giro, in the book we gave out, made this wonderful article about who is Rotzler Krebs' partner, what's special for them, and he said, it's the way they use color. So we were quite astonished to have someone from the outside, a friend, looking from the outside at what we do, telling us, guys, the color, that's what makes your projects. And it's not the soft, mellow, pinkish colors that amalgamate, but it's the orange coming out like a trumpet, or it's the red color coming up, or it's the combination of orange and gray, the contrast of colors.
What would happen to your work if that color disappeared?
Gee, if that color would disappear, well, would we use another color?
No.
Maybe?
No.
If the aspect of color
disappeared. If the extreme color disappeared.
If the extreme color
would
disappear.
You could no longer use that, or it became erased or wore off of your project.
Well, color, of course, can die out, and there's not only color. Color is the first layer of visibility, but then of course different things show up. We've started the little conversation about Kramer. I mean, he comes up with very distinct aspects of, well, earth and water, and probably that's what it's all about. I mean, our profession is about dealing topography, so it's about earth, and it's about the rain coming down from the sky. Where does the water go? How is it collected? How is it reintegrated into the soil? And then the third aspect is, how do you as a person or as a subject sense these aspects of topography and water? So that would be an answer without dollars.
Your body of work uses a series of strategies, among them sensitizing senses. I take this from your monograph, staging perception, constructing social territories, and I'll add inciting fun. However, coming back to your monograph, you've chosen, with just a couple of exceptions, to omit any photos of people enjoying your landscapes. Why?
That we discussed with our photographer. I mean, it's for our own fun, that's for sure. But photographers just don't like to see people in gardens or in architecture. And that's a mistake, as gardens are done for people, and people are the ones enjoying. Well, there's one exception in the book that we particularly like, because it's not done by an architectural photograph. That's the Latin area. You only see
the
people.
The River Edge Park. And these photos are, I find, some of the most successful.
They're extremely successful, and you see dogs, and you see people smoking, playing guitar, and so forth. And it's not about design, but it's about, well, the design people sit on, the design people don't even realize, but they use it in a good way. So I hope there's more photographs with lived-in atmosphere and with people enjoying, and not only the photographer and me or us as designers enjoying.
So your photographer had a pretty strong role in which photos were to represent your firm. If you were here, how would you set up
debate with him?
Yes.
Oh, I'd tell him that he did good photographs, and they are accepted by the journals and by the by the reviews, but I would tell him very frankly that, well, we do tell him very frankly, but he's not an extreme photographer, in the sense he only wants to have it 5 o'clock in the morning, gray and black. So he brings out the aspects that are important to us, but there could be a little more people in these pictures. You're right. I'll tell him.
Thank you. In closing, because I know you need to get to an appointment, how do you see the work of Rotzler, Krebs partner, evolving in the years to come? And is this Kramer exhibition a marking point, a transition point in your career?
I don't think it is. It's been important to go through this Kramer story again for me personally. And it could be interesting for the office, because we had quite some discussions about this way of designing projects, of reducing. And that is important in an office. If you do everything and you do it at the same time, then your hour probably has come to disappear. But as long as you're distinctive and you can express what you do and can reduce it to not 50 things at the same time, but maybe 3 or 4, and create a good relation between these main issues, then you're on a good track. And I hope you're still on a good track, and I'll have to think about what you ask me. There's 2 or 3 questions that will keep me running, or keep us running, and that's good. It's never finished. There's always a new project. There's always a new voice. There's always new aspects, and there's a lot more aspects to come, I think, for me and for my partners.
Great. Thank you for joining us. It's been a real pleasure.
For me too. Thanks, Greg.
You were listening to Terragrams, and our guest was the Swiss-German landscape architect Stefan Rötzler. Thank you for joining us for the 28th dispatch of Terragrams. Terragrams must rely exclusively on contributions from listeners like you. Your support will assure that you, your colleagues, studio, faculty body, students, and classmates can continue to benefit from our growing and open archive as well as our forthcoming discussions. If you have enjoyed the Terragrams initiative and are looking forward to our upcoming dispatches, go to our homepage at terragrams.com and select Donate. This will lead you to the PayPal site for an online contribution. Otherwise, please contact me directly at info@terragrams.com for alternate forms or methods of support. All donations count. Please help. To find out more about Terragrams and sign up for our next deliveries, please visit our website at terragrams.com or subscribe to us using iTunes. Thanks to Merete Windum for her help in research and dispatch preparation. Special thanks to the books for their wonderful and very cool music. You can expose yourself more to the books at thebooksmusic.com. Join us soon for a conversation with Chinese landscape architect Kong Jian Yu. This concludes our 28th dispatch of Terragrams. Thank you for listening.
For another job, and I also have a heart condition, and I told him I have a heart condition. I said, here, take a few dollars. I'm sorry this happened to you, but just leave me alone. I'm not the person who deposited us.
Myself, April, Tammy, and Brad.